This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If you're really passionate and interested about creating change, and if you think the conventional foodscape or food system is unsustainable and is producing ill health to individuals as well as to communities, then you need to find ways you can personally get active with others in communities and be a food activist as much as a food citizen.
Food. It's as necessary as air and water. But the systems around food production and distribution have created a good deal of distance between ourselves and our food sources. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio believes that food represents a wonderful, if somewhat untapped, opportunity for human connection. Colorado State University sociology professor Michael Carolyn joins us to discuss food as a social enterprise and his book, No One Eats Alone. We discuss how human connection is often lacking in modern food movements, talk about what it means to be a better food citizen, and define and explore what Carolyn calls foodscapes. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Michael Carolyn. His new book is entitled No One Eats Alone. He's a sociologist and an assistant dean at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. Michael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you first explain what the title means, No One Eats Alone?
I guess I kind of have, there's kind of two meanings, and it plays upon the argument that we hear all the time about how we in fact do eat alone. And I wanted to point out the fact that often there's all this discourse around when we talk about food and we talk about alternative food movements, you hear people using as a solution getting to know your farmer. And I wanted to point out that there are so many other people out there that populate our foodscape, and that narrative about just getting to know your farmer, while important in and of itself, kind of unintentionally can even obscure aspects of the food system, or what I refer to in the book as foodscapes. And just to give one example, you know, I like this example because most of our foods are fortified with vitamins, and many of our foods are fortified with vitamin D, and sometimes that's federally mandated, such as in the case of milk. But most people don't know or bother to even ask, where do the vitamins come from that are in our food? Many people just simply assume that the vitamins are kind of an inherent quality to all of our food, sometimes forgetting that they're fortified. And the question then is, where are those fortified vitamins coming from? And I talked to one gentleman who is a manager of a plant in China who is responsible for producing the vast majority of the vitamin D that goes into fortifying our foods. And as an aside, this vitamin D is extracted from lanolin in sheep from Australia. And anyway, he was talking about how it's kind of ironic how his factory is tasked with providing vitamins to make our foods nutritious and healthy, yet in the same respect, this very factory is polluting the surrounding environment, by our standards, exploitive to the labor. And so, you know, if we just think about following our food back to farmers, we forget about all these other aspects of our foodscapes that are entirely ignored. And if you really want to understand what you're eating and the impacts that what you're eating are having upon others and upon the environment, you really need to think beyond just knowing who the farmer is, because there's lots of other people that are attached to that food in one way or another.
But there's more to it in terms of the actual eating as well.
Right. It plays upon why I like to talk about foodscapes as opposed to the more conventional term, which is food system. And that's because it gets to the convivial or social aspects of eating and the convivial and social aspects that go along with kind of trying to create social change. So one of the problems I have with the foodscape term is that a foodscape is often, and I hang around a lot with economists and ag economists and policymakers, and even politicians like the term food system, but the food system is essentially as they understand it, a value chain, a commodity chain, where you have on the one end, you have farmers, you have processors, you have manufacturers, you have retailers, and at the other end, you have consumers. But we are so much more than consumers, which is kind of why I also like the term eater, because when you think about us as only being consumers, you really reduce our opportunities for creating social change. Milton Friedman talks about how the marketplace is a grand democracy, and that's true in some respects, but that understanding of democracy kind of reduces votes to dollar spent, and by that definition, those with more money get more votes and get to kind of decide what the future of that food system looks like. But if you look at foodscapes also, you understand that just voting as consumers doesn't really change anything. I kind of did a back of the envelope study, if you might call it, where I went into a local 7-Eleven and looked at the number of snack items that were in there that were produced by Pepsi-Cola, who is the largest manufacturer of food in the world. And 70% of those processed snacks were made by Pepsi. And so, you know, you can call it democracy, but if your choice is between GMO-free Satina's tortilla chips and Dorito chips that are gluten-free, for instance, but you're still ultimately talking about products that are made by Pepsi-Cola. And so my point is to also think about, when you're thinking about food and you're thinking about social change and what we can do as eaters, it has to, one solution has to be also thinking beyond just making sure we're buying the right food, but also talking about ways in which we can get together as communities and as people and as groups of people and find ways of creating social change that way as well. And that's one of the things I try to do in my book also, is I really focus on traveling kind of around the world and talking about instances where people have been able to get together and create something that's really pretty neat at smaller kind of community and regional levels that go beyond just making sure that people are buying the right stuff.
And what is the right stuff?
So I guess when people ask me what they can, I guess part of that question that's embedded in your question is kind of what can we do?
Especially with the constrictions of socioeconomic standards and what people who live in food deserts, what their options are. It's a loaded question, obviously.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So on the one hand, you have this notion that if you just buy the right stuff, you can create meaningful social change. But of course, that leaves out of the equation the people that don't have the money to, you know, meaningfully participate in this marketplace that we sometimes call a democracy. But then on the other hand, if we really want to talk about being politically active to create meaningful social change, that kind of unintentionally leaves out sometimes those same people, because there's a positive statistical correlation between financial poverty and time poverty. You know, if you're poor, economically speaking, you're probably poor in terms of the available time that you have on your hands because you're busy working multiple jobs, or maybe you're poor because you're physically disabled and therefore you don't have the time or the ability to get out of the house and do other things. And so the examples that I've kind of drawn upon are, it's really curious, regardless of if you're talking about the United States or in England or New Zealand or Australia, the successful cases that I talk about really think about what I might refer to as kind of capitals in a broader sense. We often think about capital as involving just financial capital, but there's social capital and political capital and cultural capital and all these other types of capital. And these communities have found ways of kind of bundling those resources together, where you might have people that have financial capital and might have time on their hands and might have social capital, where they're able to create. Let me just give you kind of one concrete example. You know, one of the barriers that I've discovered repeatedly from talking to the folks, regardless of their socioeconomic status, when it comes to some of these alternative food movements, is they're being exposed to fresh fruits and vegetables that they may not have the skills to know how to select what a ripe cantaloupe is, or then how the skills and how to prepare, whether it's chard or even green beans or carrots. And so one thing that I know public health officials are trying to think about is, how can we try to provide these skills to these people so that they can, you know, quote unquote, choose the right foods? And the difficulty of that is that not everybody has time to acquire those skills for those reasons I just mentioned. And so there's a lot of instances out there where people are providing, getting together as a community and thinking beyond just making finding ways to teach people, but also finding ways in which people can provide some of their other resources so that they can provide childcare as a community, maybe provide free transportation to those people that might not have transportation so they can come to these cooking classes, their children can come, there's daycare provided, maybe there's a pay scale in terms of the fresh fruits and vegetables that are being used, providing maybe community kitchen or community resources so that pots and pans and other equipment can be used, so that then you're not only finding ways of transferring these skills, but also you're kind of creating community too and creating social capital and political capital. So, I mean, that's some of the things I've looked at, is just pointing to examples where communities have really been able to get together that have been able to bridge those barriers that allow people from lower socioeconomic statuses to participate in these foodscapes and do so in a way that's meaningful to them, and also doing so in a way that doesn't also reproduce what sometimes is referred to in the critical food studies literature as reproducing eating whiteness. Because one of the things that you sometimes see is that some of these alternative food networks, they're very similar in terms of the types of fruits and vegetables they produce, in part because most of the farmers in the United States are white, and they may eat a particular way too, and so they tend to grow what they know. And that leaves out those people that might want different fruits and vegetables because of their own personal identities or cultural orientations. And so some of these spaces are intentionally really involving people from different socioeconomic and ethnic backgrounds so that not only different skills are being produced, but different skills tied to different fruits and vegetables that are tied to different kind of ethnic identities as well, so that we're not just producing kind of monolithic or homogenized foodscapes, but really diverse foodscapes, not just biologically speaking, but bioculturally speaking too.
Yes, if you've ever been to Singapore, it's one of the food capitals of the world, and I think one of the reasons is it's such a melting pot, not only of ethnicities and cooking styles, but it's also a port where there's so many different fruits and vegetables and seafood items just pouring into that city. It's quite a fantasy for food lovers, isn't it?
That's interesting. Yeah, I give a case of in Sydney, Australia, of an instance where they're kind of doing things right in that sense as well, because Sydney's an insanely diverse city with insanely diverse tastes and cultural identities too, and they're really trying to work through ways in which they can bring people together in pretty innovative ways in that same respect.
I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal you.
You rascal you.
I'll be glad when you're in your grave, you dog.
Dog.
When you're dead and in your grave, no more ravioli will you crave. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal you.
You rascal you.
I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal you.
You rascal you.
I'll be glad when you're in your grave, you dog.
Dirty dog.
I invite you to my house for a meal. All my meatballs you try to steal. You're a dirty dog.
You're dirty dog.
I will be glad when you're dead, you rascal you.
You rascal you.
I'll be glad when you're in your grave, you dog.
Dirty dog.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Michael Carolyn. His book is No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. So, Michael, we were speaking about community building through food. What do you make of the popularity of cooking shows and food networks and food as a reality TV show? Is this something that can actually help kind of stabilize food as a community builder, or do you look at it the other way?
Well, one of the challenges we have internally to our own discipline in sociology is and I'm critical of my fellow sociologists because of this, is that we tend to be critical of everything and sometimes not open to the opportunities that they may arise. And these cooking shows are kind of one of those spaces where there's a lot of that argument going on. I mean, you know, on the one hand, they certainly seem to be getting people interested once again in cooking. You know, I interview in my book a gentleman that lives in London, who is a retired marketing executive, who had been in the advertising business for decades. And his interview pops to mind here because he talked about how decades ago he was kind of charged with getting people to forget about cooking in the sense of trying to create advertisements that celebrate processed food and how it's a time saver and how it's a money saver. And he used the term, he actually, to quote him, he referred to, he feels bad about it because he feels like he's caused a generation of people. He's caused them to, he's nicked their food. He's nicked their skills. He's stolen those skills from a generation of people and others like him. So that relates to the cooking shows because in some respects we seem to be really interested in wanting to acquire some of those skills again. But on the other hand, these are again kind of very individualized solutions where you have just people sitting in their homes watching shows, figuring out ways they might be able to cook food for themselves or cook food for their families. And I talk a bit about this in our book too, in my book too, thinking about how, you know, some foodscapes draw people inwards to themselves and to think about personal things and such as individual health and what's best for them and what's best for their family. But on the other hand, you have these alternative foodscapes, which are equally interested in making sure that individuals are wanting to eat healthy food, but they also think about drawing people outward and thinking about the value of community health. You know, like the vitamin C example that I gave you, it seems like conventional foodscapes want to draw us inward and thinking about what's best for us and what's best for our families, and alternative foodscapes to some degree, while those elements are still important, really try to think, get people to think outward or try to enhance what social psychologists might call extrinsic values, is find ways that bring people together. And not just finding ways where people can look within themselves and look within what's best for their families, irregardless of what those actions might mean in terms of broader sustainability and social justice issues. And so I see some of those cooking shows as having that same effect in terms of, if not balance, they reinforce these kind of intrinsic values, and they don't do much to get people to think beyond just what's in their own interest and what's in their family's own interest, and think about those other aspects of the foodscape and the people that play a hand in populating it.
I don't really watch them, but my daughter at one stage when she was like 8 was pretty into them. So I kind of watched them with her a little bit. And I do think there is some, from a sociological standpoint, I can see some value, namely in terms of knowing how to shop, I think is one of the most important skills one can have in learning how to cook, to get fresh garlic instead of garlic salt, or just knowing what ingredients to buy is really essential to becoming a lover of fine cuisine. And so I think that kind of is instilled through a lot of these cooking shows. You don't see a lot of the just pop it in the microwave and you're good to go. There's like, it might be a little too difficult for some people, but it makes it a challenge. The other part of it, not just the cooking shows, but the food shows, like where people are going and tasting things at restaurants. And sometimes they're almost infomercials for these restaurants. But I was just talking to my sister-in-law who's going to London, and she asked, what do you recommend to do? And I don't know London that well, but I said, what I like to do when I get to a new city is to look in guidebooks for certain foods. You know, what's the best fish and chips in London? And then you got yourself a little mission for the day. And I think that can kind of come back to what you were talking about with community, because you're interacting with people, you're trying to find your way to this fish and chip shop in London, and you're having a connection to food, but you're also having a connection to people through that idea, through that adventure.
Right. And on that latter point, I absolutely agree. Another aspect of the book that I focus on as well is how foodscapes, some foodscapes at least, or food systems, pull us into interacting with people we wouldn't usually interact with. And, you know, I've really been talking a lot about this aspect just because it's so apropos to what's going on today in our political system. It seems like we have groups of people that keep talking to themselves and not talking across boundaries and creating these echo chambers. And I do see some of these practices as really inserting what I refer to in the book as empathy, something that an understanding of people that are different from ourselves that I think we desperately need in this society today. And I do think that some of these practices really do that. And that's so very important. And I like talking about that because often we talk about these alternative food systems and these different practices from a nutritional or health standpoint. But I've really found some evidence that suggests that by bringing people together and interacting with each other in ways that they may not have otherwise, we're really creating another element of which the term empathy, which is, I think, really important. And it's an underappreciated aspect of these alternative foodscapes that I think needs to be talked more about, is their ability to just get different people together and talking to each other and what that means from a political and social and cultural standpoint.
When you're talking about eating alone at your desk and then the contrast of people going out on a culinary adventure, I can't help but think of Yuval Harari's Sapiens. I don't know if you've read it, but he talks about how there's evidence that hunters and gatherers had larger cranium sizes than modern man. And he hypothesizes that it's because they had to do everything. They weren't living in a industrial agricultural society where food was just there for them. They had to really solve problems constantly, whether it be fire, hunting, gathering, protecting themselves from predators, etc. While I just picture the modern worker sitting there taking 30 minutes away from their computer to sit and eat by themselves. You can see how that cranium size could maybe relate. Not to go off on a tangent, but I think it connects with what you're saying about community and the complexity of human interaction and how food can play a role in that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I don't have much of a comment related to that other than I have to check that book out because I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, you definitely got to read it. It's fascinating. So you prefer the term foodscape to the more familiar food system. Why don't you define foodscape and why is that language important to you?
Right. Well, part of it is just simply to get people to ask that type of question so that we can think about not only what a foodscape means, but how we think about and conceptualize the alternative, which is a food system, which goes back to what I discussed earlier, just with regard to getting us to think beyond just making sure we're doing our jobs as consumers, and bringing in and introducing this idea of what I call in the book an eater citizen too. You know, it's not just making sure that we go into the store and buy the right thing, because again, there's no right thing. If you really get down and start studying, you know, food, there's always trade-offs. There's no perfect food that will solve from one extent to climate change, that will resolve social justice issues. So we really have to think more broadly, you know, getting beyond just this idea of thinking about food in terms of its impact upon nutrition or other things like that, but how it might actually even play a role in reinvigorating the public sphere from a political standpoint too, and the role these alternative food networks play in that by engendering empathy and all of that.
Maybe you can also define what an alternative food network is.
I guess if I were to define it, that's a really good question. For me, in the book at least, it's ways in which thinking about food provision just beyond what is provided in conventional commodity chains.
Would it be fair to say that it's really the variety that you're looking for, that it's the heterogeneity of food systems or foodscapes rather than something that's fairly industrialized and homogenous?
Yeah, that's fair. And in heterogeneity, just in the sense of who's involved in it, not just from a farmer standpoint or an eater standpoint, but also in the decision-making process itself in terms of, you know, where is it located? I pointed to in the book can be a really big issue as well. I interviewed people from lower socioeconomic status who were ethnic minorities who joked with me about how their nearest farmer's market is located 10 bus stops away in a white neighborhood. And one person said to me, you know, with a smile on their face, it's almost as if they don't want me there. So even just where these are located can make a huge difference in terms of their accessibility, too. And so I talk about all those different things that we need to think about when we think about these, what I guess generally call alternative food networks. And we have to really think intentionally about how we put them together and not just think, well, we've got a farmer's market here, or we've got a food co-op here. That's all we need to worry about. Let's move on to the next community and try to fix its problems.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread had a fight. Beans knocked cornbread out of sight. Beans. Cornbread said, now that's all right. Beans. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night.
Cornbread, you ain't straight. Beans. You better wake up or I'll gas you gate. Been in this pot since...
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Michael Carolyn. His new book is called No One Eats Alone. So Michael, on Sea Change Radio, we like to try to focus on solutions. What are some of the actions that someone can take to become what you had referred to as a food citizen? How can you become a better food citizen?
Well, the first thing is, yes, you have to think more about what you're going to buy when you go into a grocery store or when you're at a restaurant or which restaurants you ought to go to or ought not. Just know food better so you can make more informed consumer decisions that are important to you, not what's important necessarily to me. Because again, as I mentioned in the book, you know, while some people might be really interested in social justice issues, other people might be really interested in animal welfare issues. And so you have to first just ask yourself what's important to you and make informed decisions as a consumer based upon your own personal values. But then you have to take it to the next step as well and have to shake yourself from that uncomfortableness that we tend to have in society today about interacting more with people and finding ways you can involve yourself. If you're really passionate and interested about creating change, and if you think the conventional foodscape or food system is unsustainable and is producing ill health to individuals as well as to communities, then you need to find ways you can personally get active with others in communities and be a food activist as much as a food citizen. And that looks, it's hard to get too much in the weeds because that looks so different from one community to the next in terms of what your options might be. Maybe you live someplace where there are no other, you know, fellow food citizens / food activists. So I would say to them, you know, maybe be an innovator in that sense, but then maybe get involved at a higher level with state politics or national politics to try to create change that way too. So it's also important to think scalarly as well when you're doing this. And sometimes it's easier when living here in Fort Collins, it's easy to be active in a community at this level. But in other places, where I grew up in rural Iowa, maybe the lever for individuals there might be getting more involved with state politics and state policies or national politics and national policies. So I guess that would be my relatively short answer to that question.
The book is No One Eats Alone, and the author is Michael Carolyn. Michael, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure, Alex. I had a great time.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Chris Joss, Louis Prima, and Louis Jordan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.